morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Woody Guthrie would have been 100 years old this Saturday. Our guest this hour, Robert Santelli, is the author of This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie, Journey of an American Folk Song. And he decided to write this book and listen extensively to Woody Guthrie's music because of this song and this person.
Hey, hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song about a funny old world that's a-coming along. Seems sick and it's hungry, it's tired and it's torn. It looks like it's a-dying and it's hardly been born.
Robert Santelli is the author of This Land Is Your Land. He actually has written many, many books on American music, including the Bob Dylan scrapbook, Readings from E Street, the story of Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, and the Big Book of Blues. He's the former vice president of education and public programs at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum and CEO of Experience Music Project in Seattle. He is now heading the Grammy Museum in Los Angeles, and he is going to be, well, he's already been extensively involved in a commemoration of Woody Guthrie's life and music during this centennial year, not only in this country, but also internationally, because Woody Guthrie was an international artist. Robert is with us this hour. We'll also have a great privilege of listening to a great deal of music from Woody Guthrie, a complicated man, much more than a voice and a guitar. I love what John Steinbeck had to say about Woody Guthrie, and we'll tell you what he had to say as the hour goes on. Here is our phone number for you to join the conversation. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And the Facebook page where we've put up some songs and a tribute to Woody Guthrie is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And Robert, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I loved reading your book. There is so much to this man. He's a voice and a guitar, but he is a complicated soul. And what he weaves together about what America is and what America could be is worth examining forever, really, isn't it? He's kind of a person for the ages.
He certainly is. And you just said it absolutely right when you said that he's a complicated man. On the surface, he's a very simple man. You know, the way he presented himself as just a simple Okie from Oklahoma was only partly true. Underneath was a man of great intellect, a well-read man, someone who really thought deeply about politics and political philosophy and the plight of the common man in this country.
Tell me more about your own journey with Woody Guthrie. That song from Dylan is so beautiful, isn't it? I know you were captivated by Guthrie because of Dylan.
Yes, you know, but actually my initial introduction to Woody came rather unknowingly to me. When I was a kid in elementary school, I'm a baby boomer, and like many other baby boomers who grew up on the East Coast in the New York, New Jersey metropolitan area, I was first introduced to Woody Guthrie by my music teacher, who taught us the elements of singing, group singing, by teaching us This Land Is Your Land. And I remember her saying it was a great patriotic song, it was a great sing-along song, and never told us anything about who wrote it, at least I don't recall, or anything about the man. But years later, when I had first come across Bob Dylan, and I heard the song that you played called Song to Woody. It's such a captivating song, and I listened intently to the lyrics as a young teen, and I said, wow, who is Woody Guthrie? And I went back and did a little research and bought a couple of albums in Greenwich Village, and I realized that Woody Guthrie was the same one who wrote This Land Is Your Land. I said, I know him already somehow through the music of This Land Is Your Land. And that really began a kind of a career-long love affair with not just Guthrie and what he stood for, but his music, certainly.
And because the book is called This Land Is Your Land, and this song is so incredibly influential, not only decade after decade, but in this country and throughout the world, let's start with that song. You say it certainly his most popular and most influential, and there was a movement to replace the Star Spangled Banner with that song, which I'm all in favor of. But anybody familiar with the lyrics knew that this would never happen because of the contents of the lyrics that most people have never heard. It was a call to action in addition to a hymn to the country.
That's true. You know, the song is written in 1940 in New York City. It was written clearly as a response to Irving Berlin's God Bless America. And we know that for a fact because the original title of This Land Is Your Land was God Blessed, past tense, God Blessed America. And Guthrie, I had a sense, and there are people who disagree with me, but I had a sense that he liked the talents of Irving Berlin, and he liked the singer, Kate Smith, who sang the song. What he didn't approve of was the fact that Berlin, with his song, only told part of the story of America. It was the great part. It was the part about how wonderful we are as a country, that we're blessed by God, and what a great country. And, of course, this is on the eve of World War II. It was designed pretty much to make us feel good about our country as we prepared for war. Guthrie, on the other hand, thought, yeah, that's true about America, but there's another side of America that, Irving, you didn't talk about, and I will. So he writes this song, God Bless America, and he adds verses that most people don't know. Certainly today, we've all but forgotten them. And they're verses about how people were on the relief lines and had nothing to eat and no jobs. After all, it was the Great Depression. We're still in it just before World War II. And then also about the no trespassing, the famous line that he sees a sign that says no trespassing. But on the other side, it didn't say anything. It was blank. And that side was made for you and me. And that really comes from Guthrie's tremendous concern about how many people were losing their farms and houses mm-hmm. to bank foreclosures, much like today. And he wanted to make sure that, you know, those people who are gobbling up the farms, particularly the banks, were doing this and put up no trespassing signs. Well, guess what? You know, that's not something that we normally sing about, but Guthrie was going to sing about it in his song because, for him, that's a part of America that wasn't being sung about, and he wanted to do that.
Nobody living can ever stop me as I go walking that freedom highway. Nobody living can ever make me turn back. This land was made for you and me. In the squares of the city, in the shadow of a steeple by the relief office, I'd seen my people as they stood there hungry. I stood there asking, is this land made for you and me?
That's right.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
This is a long story, but start us wherever you want to start us with how he was able to get the vision to see the suffering, to be able to relate all of that. He obviously took in a lot of what humans were living in those years. Where did he start? How did he gather all of those images that's translated to his music?
Woody Guthrie is born in Oklahoma, Okemah, Oklahoma. In 2 days, we'll celebrate his 100th anniversary on July 14th. Makes his way to Pampa, Texas in the mid-1930s, and it's in the Texas Panhandle region that he encounters two things. He starts to encounter the deep ravages of the Great Depression. He sees neighbors, friends, relatives, etc., lose houses, lose farms due to their inability to pay the mortgage. And he also sees the ecological disaster that besets the Midwest, particularly in Texas and Kansas and parts of Oklahoma, and that, of course, is the Great Dust Bowl. Mm-hmm. So this is a real 1-2 punch to the working man of this particular area, and many have to leave. They don't have a place to live because the banks have taken their farms, or nature has ruined their farms with all the dust. And so they head out and they head west because California is, from what they can gather, the land of dreams and opportunities where they could rebuild their lives and start over. Woody Guthrie follows them and gets out to California in the mid-1930s, and they realize that for many people who had left, the Okies from Oklahoma, the Arkies from Arkansas, the Texies from Texas, they get out there and realize that the California dream turns into a California nightmare for many of them, because those jobs, they were far and few between. There was no help. The California state government was very cold to these immigrants coming into the state. Many of these people began to sleep under railroad bridges, on the sides of in their cars, on the sides of roads, in migrant camps, etc. Lots of problems between the unions and the government and the big landowners, the fruit owners, and what happens, of course, is violence. Guthrie sees all of this, is horrified by it. These are his people, and begins to do what he would be able to do best, and that is to write music about it, and mostly become a musical editorial page. You know, he'll see this and he'll write about it, and ultimately lands a little gig on a radio station, a very progressive radio station in Los Angeles, and begins to create the persona of Woody Guthrie. He starts to sing songs from back home that the Arkies and the Okies listen to, and they're reminded of back home, and he starts to sing his new songs about them and their plight in California. And that's when Woody Guthrie becomes politicized, and that's when Woody Guthrie, as we would know him in history, becomes Woody Guthrie.
Mm-hmm. Robert talked about the Dust Bowl, which was a huge event, historic event, that Woody wrote about. And before we start taking phone calls for our guests, it's worth hearing a bit of Woody Guthrie and talking Dust Bowl blues.
Back in 1927, I had a little farm and I called that heaven. Well, the price is up and the rain come down, and I hauled my crops all into town. I got the money, bought clothes and groceries, fed the kids and raised the family. Rain quit and the wind got high, and a black old dust storm filled the sky. And I swapped my farm for a Ford machine, and I poured it full of this gas Eileen. And I started rocking and rolling over the mountains out towards the old Peach Bowl.
Woody Guthrie and talking Dust Bowl blues. His family, Robert, was with him as he made this trek to California?
No. He had been recently married in the early 1930s, had a couple of kids, and he decided to keep them at home until he could get out to California and establish himself, and then his plan was to call for his family, which eventually he did. But in those early months, he went out by himself, got himself out there by train and hitchhiking, and arrives in Los Angeles pretty much broke, begins to play on Skid Row, and, you know, for passing, for putting money in a cap and a hat, and over time he begins to earn enough money where his wife Mary and his two kids would be able to join him, and they do join him out there, but they don't stay because Guthrie was a man who couldn't stay in any one place too long. He wasn't a very good father. He wasn't a very good husband. His commitment was to people and to his music and how that music related to the people. And so they kind of trailed around with him, but eventually they would split, and Woody would simply become Woody. He would marry two other times in his life, but never was he a man that would stay in any place for long periods of time. He couldn't. He traveled back and forth across this country, up and down this country, and did it in a way that allowed him to gather a wealth of experience, and lots of those experiences find their way into song.
Did they ever find their way into song? The astonishing output of this man, the number of songs that he composed, the books that he wrote, the cartoons that he drew, he was just an endless source of writing and of thought, wasn't he?
It was an obsession with him. I don't think a day went by in his life where he didn't write something, whether it was a letter, a postcard, a song or songs, drawings, illustrations, letters to the editor, columns, newspaper columns, whatever. He had to write. There was this need for him where it's almost like breathing for him. You know, he had to do it. There's some great indications in the Woody Guthrie archives that I found where Woody would read a newspaper in the morning and in the afternoon write two or three songs about a particular article that he had read. And as he was doing, he'd cut out the article and make notes on the side and then turn it into lyrics. He felt the need to do this in a way that few other artists feel the need so regularly and so so deeply. Over 3,000 songs is what
Remarkable.
He wrote that we know of. Yeah, it's
3,000 songs.
Yeah, and we're talking about a period. You know, Guthrie, even though he lived until he was 55, the truth is that his writing career was about 15 years, because by the late 1940s and early 1950s, he begins to see in himself this dreaded disease that killed his mother and that ultimately would kill him, called Huntington's disease. It's a horrible disease. It's a disease that will rob him of his ability to write, to sing, to play guitar. He'll lose weight. He'll get to the point where he can't even swallow. And then he ultimately dies in October of 1967.
Woody Guthrie, 2 days from now, would have turned 100 years old. The author of This Land Is Your Land, Robert Santilli, is our guest. Robert is also heavily involved in commemorations of Woody Guthrie's life and work all over this country and also internationally. We'll be welcoming phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Leave messages on our Facebook page as well.
If you'll gather around me, children, a story I will tell about pretty boy Floyd, an outlaw. Oklahoma knew him well. It was in the town of Shawnee, a Saturday afternoon. His wife beside him in his wagon as into town they rode.
This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Pete Seeger, who it probably could be said kept that song very much alive during the 60s and 70s in this country, and actually still does, This Land Is Your Land. We want to talk about his relationship with Pete Seeger and with John Steinbeck and others. Woody Guthrie would have been 100 this Saturday, and we're talking about his life and his music and welcoming phone calls. Our guest is the author of This Land Is Your Land, Robert Santilli. Let's talk about, again, another complicated relationship with Pete Seeger, who didn't like being around the guy all that much but missed him desperately whenever they were apart. He kept that song alive during the 60s in the 70s and still does. We could credit him with the current popularity of This Land Is Your Land, don't you think, Robert?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, take it back even a decade farther to the 1950s. When Pete, you know, Pete had, as you said, a very interesting relationship with Woody Guthrie. When Woody met him in 1940, he had spent some time with Pete in Washington, D.C., Alan Lomax, Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, and Library of Congress, and they were working on a project together. And Pete had come from Harvard University. He came from a patrician family, very properly raised in New England. Woody Guthrie, of course, comes from the Dust Bowl and the Oklahoma Territory, and all of a sudden these two meet. And Woody couldn't believe that a guy Pete's age, Pete was in his early 20s, who didn't smoke, didn't drink, didn't chase women, all three things that Woody Guthrie did regularly, how could you be interested in folk music? That's not the kind of people that we attract. And yet there was this underlying connection between the two. They both had a fascination about how music can impact and affect political, social change in this country. Pete saw Woody as a mentor, and they traveled around the country together. They performed in a group called the Almanac Singers. And Pete told me during the interviews for the book that at first, when he heard This Land Is Your Land, he wasn't impressed. He didn't think it was such a great song. But later, it grew on him and grew on him some more, so that by the time Woody got to be incapacitated with Huntington's, Pete decided to pick up the mantle and make sure that Guthrie's music, particularly This Land Is Your Land, wouldn't be forgotten. And in the 1950s, when Pete Seeger was blacklisted from radio and TV in this country because of his connections to communism back in the 1930s, what you had was Pete Seeger going around these progressive summer camps in the 1950s to kids whose parents were liberals or progressives out of New York City in particular. They'd send their kids up to camps in New York State, and Pete would go up and play for them. Hmm. And he taught them, "This land is your land." At the same time this was happening, the publishing company called the Richmond Organization would begin giving out free to textbook publishers the song "This Land is Your Land," minus the lyrics that had, in all truth, become a little bit irrelevant in the 1950s. America was back to work, and the Depression had ended. So those lyrics were dropped. It made it very convenient for textbook publishers to get the song for free, and if you took away those controversial lyrics, the song was a perfect patriotic song to sing, which is how I got to learn how to sing the song, as I've already said. But it was Seeger and the Richmond Organization that made sure that song made it through the 1950s and then into the 60s when it really began to grow in popularity, and of course there's been no stopping it.
And then it was sung at the inauguration of Barack Obama.
Which was pretty amazing. I always, writing that last chapter, which of course in the book is all about Pete Seeger and Bruce Springsteen singing at the inauguration, I just can't help but wonder, you know, how Woody would have felt. And I asked Nora Guthrie, his daughter, and Arlo Guthrie, his son, and they said, wow, he would have been thrilled, you know. First, you know, to see that America had elected, finally, an African-American president, and second, to have his song sung at his inauguration would have been just, you know, the complete cycle for that song, and basically would have accounted for the relevancy of Woody Guthrie's life and career and all the music that he wrote.
Let's take some phone calls. Martha on Highway 40. Hi, Martha.
Hello. This is just wonderful. I've been listening to Woody Guthrie songs since the 1970s, and "This Machine Kills Fascists," the greatest bumper sticker that never appeared on a bumper, you know, and how appropriate his things are today. It's just amazing. But my question is, one of my favorite Woody Guthrie songs of recent, and I play a little guitar, so I've studied this over the years, but is a song that actually was not, you can correct me, was not a song. It was just some verse that Woody wrote, or maybe he never got around to putting it to music. But a British musician, Billy Bragg, wrote the music for a song called "Way Over Yonder in the Minor Key." And it's more about Woody's history of with women and despoiling women, as we used to say. And I'm curious why we don't see more of that.
Well, I can tell you that what has happened in recent years is that Nora Guthrie, who is Woody's daughter and oversees the Woody Guthrie Archives in New York State, has invited certain musicians to come in and put music to the many songs that still exist in the archives that were never recorded at all, to come in and put music to those lyrics. Billy Bragg is certainly one of those. Wilco is a group that was invited in to do that as well. Together, Billy Bragg and Wilco did an album called Mermaid Avenue. And Mermaid Avenue is in honor of the street in Coney Island where the family lived in the 1940s and 50s. The song that you're referring to is a great song. It's one of the best songs, in my opinion, on that album. And, you know, Woody just didn't write about politics and about people. Those 3,000 songs, there's all kinds of songs in there about women, about kids. He wrote tons of young people songs, kids songs, children's songs, amazing stuff. So you, over the course of the next decade or so, you're going to see more Woody Guthrie songs like this come out. And for those of you who know the Mermaid Avenue album, you might remember maybe one of the best songs on that record, I think, is called California Stars. And it's written by Woody, lyrics by Woody, and music by Wilco. And it's really Woody Guthrie longing for his days in California back in the late 1930s. Wonderful song as well.
Here's a song that many people will be familiar with. They heard it as children. They sing it to their children. Speaking of a different kind of genre for him, Woody Guthrie and the Car Song.
Engine, it goes drr, drr. Engine, it goes drr, drr. Front seat, back seat, boys and girls, take you riding in my car. Trees in the houses walk along, trees in the houses walk along, truck in a cart and a garbage can, I'll take you riding in my car.
Woody Guthrie and the Cars song. I don't know how he does that. Do you know how to do that, Robert?
I tried once or twice.
Have you? Yeah.
But you know who did an amazing song in 1996 when I was at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? We did a concert that saluted the importance of Woody Guthrie because he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a rock and roll pioneer. That means essentially someone who predated rock and roll but who had influenced the birth of rock and roll. And we had Bruce Springsteen played at the concert that that we did at Severance Hall in Cleveland, Ohio. And, you know, there's 3,000 songs. And what song does Bruce Springsteen decide to interpret with the car song? And it was fantastic. The interesting thing about that song and about many songs that Woody writes, they're all works in progress. You know, every time I hear that song, I hear a different verse. And you know, Woody encouraged, change the lyrics, change the words, change them to meet your needs, and change them to meet the time and place you're singing it. So lots of verses to Car song.
Is that on tape somewhere? I'd love to see that. Springsteen.
Yes, actually, Ani DiFranco, a great songwriter and a progressive protest songwriter, and she performed at that concert. She has a label called Righteous Babes. And she released a live album from that show called Till We Outnumber Them. I think it's still available, but if you buy that record, that CD, you'll be able to get Springsteen's version of Car.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that. I want to talk a little bit about John Steinbeck and when Woody met John and their relationship. I loved what Steinbeck had to say about Woody. I mean, it's kind of lofty, but I think that there's a great deal of truth in this. He sings the songs of a people, and I suspect that he is, in a way, that people. Harsh-voiced and nasal, his guitar hanging like a tire iron on a rusty rim, there is nothing sweet about Woody, and there is nothing sweet about the songs he sings. But there is something more important for those who listen. There is the will of a people to endure and fight against oppression. I think we call this the American spirit.
That's beautiful.
Isn't it beautiful?
Yeah. Woody Guthrie, of course, and John Steinbeck, these are two pillars of understanding through American art the situation of the 1930s, the Dust Bowl, as well as the oppression that, you know, poor people felt, as well as the Great Depression. And if you listen to the music of Woody Guthrie and read John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, mm-hmm. look at Dorothea Lange's photographs, and boy, you get a great picture. It's not a pretty picture, but it's an accurate picture, and it's one that can touch the heart. And there is another quote from John Steinbeck, which I find equally powerful. When The Grapes of Wrath, of course, came out, it was a big hit. The book was a big hit, and of course the movie was a big hit as well. And Woody Guthrie had written a song about Tom Joad, Tom Joad being the main character in Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. And John Steinbeck heard the song called Tom Joad, and basically it said in so many words, "That little bastard, what it took me an entire novel to write, he got right in a short song." And that probably was very accurate, because it takes John Steinbeck 350 right. pages to tell the story of the Joad family. Woody Guthrie knocked it out in one night with about 16 verses or whatever it might be. I can't
let's
recall.
Let's hear some of that now. Tom Joad.
And there it was, and that was the story. And, of course, Bruce Springsteen has carried on that tradition with a famous song of his called The Ghost of Tom Joad. So Joad is a pretty powerful name, not only in American literature, but also in American folk music.
Woody Guthrie and Tom.
Tom Joad got out of the old McAllister pen. There he got his parole. After 4 long years on a man-killing charge, Tom Joad come walking down the road. Poor boy, Tom Joad come walking down the road. Tom Joad, he met a truck-driving man. There he called him a ride.
Woody Guthrie and Tom Joad. Let's go to more phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. You're listening to the Ideas Network here on Wisconsin Public Radio, and we are talking about Woody Guthrie, who would have turned 100 years old this coming Saturday. Our guest is Robert Santelli, author of a wonderful book on Woody Guthrie, This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie, Journey of an American Folk Song. And Robert has written many, many books on American music, including the Bob Dylan scrapbook, Greetings from E Street, the story of Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. He's currently heading the Grammy Museum in Los Angeles, and he is involved in putting together celebrations of Woody Guthrie's life and music all over this country and internationally in celebration of this centennial year. Two more phone calls. Please join us if you'd like. 800-486-8655. Richard in Fort Atkinson. Hi.
Hello. Well, of course, just like many of your callers, I grew up with Pete and Woody Guthrie. But let me tell you, I find the song This Land Is Your Land, made for you and me, I find that profoundly irritating. When we're talking about the Tom Joad song and This Land Is Your Land, we're talking about difficulties, stresses, inequalities within the white European Christian community. We're not talking about anything else. I live here in southern Wisconsin, and the blood that the land that I live on is soaked in the blood of Black Hawk and his people. We forget that the you and me are the people whose politics and actions have been based upon greed and avarice, and the you and me are any place are us, and wherever we can place a military base and say this land is your land. And that certainly was the case in 1846 when we said to Mexico, give us California and Nevada, et cetera. And they said no, and so we simply took two-thirds of their
country.
Yeah,
but Richard, that's not what this song is. I mean, that isn't the message that Woody Guthrie was giving us with this song at all, was it, Robert?
No, it wasn't. And as a matter of fact, Richard, one thing you should know, in 1969, Pete Seeger and Arlo Guthrie were singing that song. It was in Washington, D.C.
Whoops. Well, we have lost our guest, but we'll find him again. He just faded. I don't know if we lost the phone line or what. We are this hour talking about a great deal of emphasis on This Land Is Your Land because it's the name of our guest's book, but also because this song is the one that may not be Woody Guthrie's best song, but certainly his most popular and influential. So, but there are many other songs, too. Are you there now, Robert?
I am.
Okay.
I apologize. I don't know what happened there.
I don't either, but go ahead.
As I was saying, in 1969, Pete Seeger was singing This Land Is Your Land in Washington, D.C., and some Native American chiefs came up to him and said exactly what Richard said. Said, wait a minute. This land was our land. Mm-hmm. This land is my land. It's not your land. And Pete was pretty much taken aback by that, and he said, you know what? You're right. He said, you know what you should do? You should sing this song and redo the lyrics and take that song. And that's exactly what they did. So, you know, the spirit of the song, the spirit of Woody, the spirit of Pete Seeger was directly in line with what Richard is saying there. This land was supposed to be for everyone.
Right.
Woody didn't make discriminations against race, color, creed, any of that. He was for all the people, mm-hmm. Native Americans included. So that song actually does represent Native Americans, and they have changed the lyrics to suit them, and Woody, I'm sure, was smiling from folk song heaven and certainly encouraged that to happen.
Karen in Eau Claire sends us an email saying, I was with part of an international group once where a group of Canadians claimed that song was clearly written about Canada. Just listen to the words they said. I've never heard that theory anywhere else. They even sang it as part of a program about Canada.
Well, there used to be a verse called From the Canadian Rockies. Clearly, there's a connection to Canada there. But I'll tell you what, that song, This Land Is Your Land, has been sung in over three dozen languages. It's embraced all over the world. The Guthrie family has encouraged people to take that song, redo the lyrics, and make that song your own so that you can sing it and have it make sense for your cause, your people, your land, your possibilities. So the fact that the Canadians have taken it makes total sense to me. That song also was a work in progress. There are many different lyrics to This Land Is Your Land, written by Woody himself. And then, of course, there are the dozens of other lyrics. I remember hearing a bunch of school kids singing, this school is my school, this school is your school, you know, and just changing it there, talking about their local teachers and how great they were and stuff. So this song has great meaning for many people literally around the world, and this year more than ever because of the centennial. We got lots of people singing it and lots of people sending us versions of that song.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about the centennial. How are you marking it in America and also internationally?
We kicked off the Woody Guthrie Centennial in March, and we thought the appropriate place to do it would be in Oklahoma. So in March of this past year, we had a major conference that dealt with Woody Guthrie's time and life in Oklahoma and Texas, and it occurred at the University of Tulsa. And we had a big concert in Tulsa that allowed us to celebrate his music with people like John Mellencamp, Del McCurry, Roseanne Cash, certainly Arlo Guthrie, Jackson Brown, and others. We tried to follow Woody Guthrie's biography because after that he went to Texas, and so did we. We did concerts in Pampa and Austin, Texas, and then ultimately moved to Los Angeles, where the home of the Grammy Museum, where we did a big conference on Woody Guthrie at the University of Southern California in April, followed by a big concert in Los Angeles, which, again, Jackson Brown, Graham Nash, and many others, almost a dozen artists, Tom Morello and other
nice
local Los Angeles artists. And now, this week, of course, in 2 days, we'll be in Okemah, Oklahoma, the birthplace of Woody Guthrie, for the big Woody Guthrie Festival. But the family itself will be in New York, and they'll be playing Central Park. It will be just family members celebrating either great-granddad, granddad, or dad, and then they'll go to Coney Island, where Woody Guthrie's ashes, some years ago in 1967, were actually let loose on the Atlantic Ocean, and they'll do a formal ceremony there, and then finally it's on to the Edmonton Folk Festival in Canada, and we go to the Newport Folk Festival in Rhode Island. We go to Penn State, where another conference takes place in September, dealing with Woody Guthrie and union activities, a big concert there. We get to Brooklyn for Brooklyn College, a big conference there in September, and it all kind of
ends up
on the 14th of October at the Kennedy Center for a major concert.
Wonderful. We welcome more phone calls. Here's how you reach us. We're talking about Woody Guthrie this hour of the program. He would have been 100 this coming Saturday. Robert Santelli is our guest, executive director of the Grammy Museum, author of This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie and the Journey of an American Folk Song. Join us at 800-486-8655 or send an email at talk@wpr.org. We also have some tributes on our Facebook page, the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Arizona, I make all your crops, and it's north up to Oregon to gather your hops. Dig the beets from your ground, cut the grapes from your vine to set on your table your light sparkling wine. Tell me what was their names, tell me what was their names. Did you have a friend on that good Ruth and James? What was their names, tell me what was their names. Did you have a friend on that good Ruth and James?
Woody Guthrie and Reuben James, and before that you heard Pastures of Plenty. Woody Guthrie, this hour, Robert Santelli is our guest, author of This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie, Journey of an American Folk Song. Returning to phone calls, and Rebecca in Monroe. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I was doing some family genealogy, and I had a person by the name of Nancy Emmeline Guthrie in my family, and it goes back probably about 5 generations from Kentucky, and it turns out that she is related to an ancestor of Woody, and I can tell you and the folks out there that they evidently have a long line of being very poor people, so he probably had a whole history of knowing what the hardships of, trying to make a living was, even farther than Oklahoma. So,
Robert.
Yes, you know, his roots go back a number of generations in America, and most of those generations did struggle. And the interesting thing, however, is when Woody was born into his family, his father, Charlie, had been doing quite well. Actually, they would have been considered, at the time of Woody Guthrie's birth and just a few years into his childhood, they would have been considered, in Oklahoma, upper middle class. But he loses it all, and it's very quick that they go back to scraping a living, and of course, once the Great Depression hits, they sink even deeper. Woody made money during his life, but not a lot of money, and what money he made, some of it went back to his kids, and a lot of it he just, who knows what he did with it, but he didn't save it. He wasn't very good in terms of finance. He didn't really care about money so much. He just is, well, feed somebody on the side of the road, or oftentimes gave his guitar away. This was a man who liked to live pretty much very simply, and he was a very generous man with his time, his money, his talent. So he and his family struggled most of their lives.
Isn't that a wonderful description of somebody, to be a generous person?
Yes, and not only was Woody generous with money and his time, but his life. I mean, he really dedicated it to trying to do good with music, trying to tell stories that would improve people's lives or teach people something or teach the government something. He felt very, very committed and very proud when the music could have an impact. And a fascinating man, someone who had tall tales and small tales to tell, because he had literally crisscrossed the country. I would recommend to your readers, if they're interested, he wrote a book called Bound for Glory. It came out in the mid-1940s, and it's really an autobiographical novel. It was meant to be a memoir, but there's too many stretches of the truth in there to be a true memoir, and that was Woody's way. But what a great piece of literature that is a good companion piece, if you will, to Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath.
Yes.
And you'll get a real sense of the literary genius of Woody Guthrie as well.
Robert in Stevens Point, our next caller. Hi, Robert.
Hello.
Yes. Hello.
Yes, continuing on that theme of somebody mentioned earlier about saying that Woody Guthrie wasn't really concerned about anybody but white Americans. I suppose this is just good time as any to bring up mention the song "Deep Ortiz," which I believe is about illegal immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
You
know,
comment on that.
There's no question. Like I said, he often. Some of his closest friends were African Americans. Leadbelly, he considered to be a close friend and mentor. Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, the bluesman up from North Carolina, became very good friends of his. But you're absolutely right when you say Deportees, also known as Plane Wreck at Los Gatos, is based on a true story where a plane load of illegal immigrants were being sent back to Mexico. The plane crashes, and in the report of the plane crash, all they did was mention the deaths of the pilots. And for the rest of the people on the plane, the illegal immigrants, they just said, well, they were just deportees. Guthrie took that as a personal insult. How can anyone be, after they died in a fiery plane crash, they were here to try to better themselves, they're being sent back, and you can't even name the names of the deceased? So what Guthrie does is he writes a song, and he doesn't know the names because they don't tell the names in the newspaper, but he comes up with names, and he writes a very powerful, very moving song about the inhumanity of the way in which the media handled that tragedy, but also a broader issue of how we treated illegal immigrants, but not just illegal immigrants, but also legal immigrants in this country, that if you were a brown-skinned person and you were working in California or the Southwest, that chances are you did not get the same rights, privileges, and have the same kind of human respect that white people did, and that bothered Guthrie immensely. And he wrote about it to great effect.
Mm-hmm. And you told it to great effect. Tony in Athens. Hi, Tony.
Hi, thanks for having me on. I'm a huge Woody Guthrie fan, so huge, in fact, that I have two sons. I named my first son's middle name is Guthrie, And I tell everyone that's Woody, not Arlo. My second son's middle name is Seeger. And I tell everyone that if I have a third son, his middle name will be Leadbelly. I'm still trying to convince my wife of that, though. But I am absolutely a huge fan. I love Pastures of Plenty, Talkin' Union. And I just, my comment is that Woody Guthrie was a communist. And people, I feel like on a lot of the NPR shows, they did it on Talk of the Nation, on NPR, they tiptoe around this, but he was a communist in the sense, not that he was like a bug-eyed Stalinist, but he was a person who thought power should be broad and work should be valued and respected and dignified, and it should be broadly held so people could live dignified lives in that way. Now, we'd have broad wealth in this country, and we'd have humanizing conditions, and that's why he wrote these songs. And he realized the American dream wasn't just given out, but had to be fought for. It had to be fought so people could have a decent middle-class standard of living and that immigrants could be humanized. And I think a great contemporary artist who tries to live up to that is, well, many, many artists do, but David Rovix does a lot of great current stuff. He's a more obscure folk singer, not as well known, but he does some great work. And I just like your comment on how, like, I don't think that's embraceable, Woody. I think because all of America needs to hear Woody and celebrate Woody, and it's alienating to know that Woody was a communist, but we have to articulate why he was that and what that stood for,
Robert,
and what it continues to stand for today.
Robert, thanks very much for the call. Tony, Robert.
Yes, well, he wasn't an official communist. He was never invited to be a part of the party. He was not a card-carrying communist. When I asked Pete Seeger about it, he laughed. He said the Communist Party would never allow Woody Guthrie in it because Woody Guthrie didn't abide by rules, and the Communist Party was all about rules and regulations. Philosophically, however, he certainly sided with the communist and particularly the socialist ideology that was certainly prevalent among artists and intellectuals in the 1930s. And the reason why this is true is because Guthrie saw firsthand that how capitalism had been so cruel to poor people. And when he saw those bank foreclosures happening time and again throughout Oklahoma and Texas, he felt terrible about it and looked for alternative ways in which the government can serve its people. And, of course, in the 1930s, there were many actors, actresses, writers, painters, poets, novelists that experimented or flirted with socialism and even communism. Once World War II come along, however, and they realized that communism was not the panacea. It was not the thing that everyone had believed it was, with Stalin and his camps and his connection to Adolf Hitler. Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, everybody turned against Soviet Russia. Mm-hmm. And then Woody Guthrie wrote dozens upon dozens mm-hmm. of anti-fascist songs, defeat Hitler songs during World War II. Woody Guthrie, in my view, was a patriot, and it was someone who had the courage to look beyond the norm and the convention of the way America did business with its people, particularly economically. And so it's not surprising to me that he would do this, but to think that he was a card-carrying communist, there's no indication in the archives or anywhere else that he was that. He did write for a communist newspaper. He had a column called Woody Says, and he also sang at communist rallies, but not a Communist Party member.
Let's go to Ken in Pewaukee. Hi, Ken.
Hello.
Hi.
I was wondering if you could tell me, back in the New Deal, FDR had the WPA, the CCC, et cetera, but I thought he had also had an artist program where not only musicians, but visual artists as well were commissioned to write songs. I was wondering if you could remember the name of that New Deal program and if Woody was part of that.
Woody was part of it for a very brief time. In 1941, the Bonneville Power Administration up in the great Pacific Northwest had commissioned Woody Guthrie to come up there and to write songs about the experience of creating this great dam and providing electricity to rural Pacific Northwesters in a way that would bring them up into the 20th century. Guthrie went up there and in about 30 days wrote about 26, 27 amazing songs. It was one of his most prolific months ever. From that, we get one of his best songs, very close to This Land Is Your Land in my heart, is called Pastures of Plenty. One of the callers had already mentioned that. brilliant song, but also Grand Coulee Band and many, many others. He got paid about $300 or so to write those songs. Very proud of the fact that he had done that. And those songs and Woody Guthrie's connection up there still lives, and they're still very proud of it. But he didn't do what the others did. There, you know, a lot of painters were commissioned to do murals in post offices and libraries and things. The problem with Guthrie was he was his own man. I mean, he had a hard time adhering to convention, to rules, regulations. The fact that he pulled it off up in the Pacific Northwest was pretty amazing. But whenever it came time to kind of put Woody Guthrie in a chair and force him to do something, that's the time he left and got back out on the road.
Robert, thank you so much for being with us. I love the book. We're going to put music and tributes on our Facebook page and have a rip-roaring, wonderful time at all of these celebrations. You've enticed us. I'd like to be at all of them. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Robert Santelli, the book is This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie, Journey of an American Folk Song. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning for producing this program and all the extra attention to music and the essence of Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
So long, it's been good to know you. There's a mighty big war that's got to be won. We'll get back together again. So it won't be long till the fascists are gone. All of their likes are finished and done. We'll throw the dirt into their face and we'll walk away from that lonesome grave singing, so long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. So long, it's been good to know you. There's a mighty big war that's got to be won. We'll get back together again.